Bang, and you're listening to Syracuse University GradCast. I sat down recently with Chris Katerine. He has a PhD in classics from UVA and is currently working in consulting. He's a recent author of the book, Leaving Academia, A Practical Guide, which is a really terrific book that, as it suggests, offers you some really concrete ways of thinking about how to leave academia. It's not merely mourning what could have been or thinking about how to get back into academia. It's really focused on how to be proactive and what to do once you've made the decision not to stay in academia. And so I met Chris possibly over a year ago toward the beginning of the pandemic when we were shut down, and we connected on LinkedIn, and we had a great conversation then, and we lost track until Glenn Wright brought him to campus for a humanities residence earlier this year. And so I was very pleased to be able to catch up with him and to offer this podcast, which is invaluable to anybody considering alternative careers, or as we might really frame them, just careers. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to GradCast, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me.
I wanted to start off with you telling us a bit about your transition from your PhD in classics out of academia and into the work that you do now.
Yeah, that's a long story, and longer, I think, than it really needed to be. And for me, I think it was like 2.5, almost 3 years. And there are really two halves to that story. And one half is professional, really focused on the academics, what was pushing me out. And the other side is really personal and what was pulling me towards a different type of career. So on the professional side, I got really anxious after what we then called a bad year on the academic job market. This was 2014-15. And I think there were 50 jobs in my discipline, across the US and Canada. And I said, well, this isn't looking great. Who knows how things are going to go? And so that spring, I met with a handful of administrators and thought about what I call a soft pivot into higher ed administration. But after having a few meetings that spring, early summer, I really leaned back into research and teaching for about 9 months and said, I'm gonna give the academic job market one more try. The next year, the academic job market was worse, 35 jobs, I think, none in my subdiscipline. And I said, okay, well, hey, maybe it's time to stage an exit while I still have a couple months or maybe even a year and a couple months left of my contract, with income and health insurance. Those are nice things to have. And staging an exit while you have that cushion is good. On the personal side, though, it sort of evolved in tandem. And in early 2016, my wife was offered a tenure track job at a small college in the Midwest. And the school looked like a really good fit for her and for us on paper. But when she actually went to visit, it just didn't work for her or for us culturally and politically. And she didn't think she was going to get the job, and they made an offer to her, and it was an agonizing 2 or 3 weeks that involved a trip up there to visit. And she eventually turned down that tenure track job. And this was really a critical moment for both of us, I think, because it totally changed our thinking. And we went from this attitude of how bad would a tenure track job have to be to say no, to how good would a tenure track job have to be to either pull us away from one another or pull us away from New Orleans, which was a city we'd been in at that point for a year and a half and had really fallen in love with. And, her job was renewable. Mine was not. And so at that point, we're saying, well, we like New Orleans. We don't think there's going to be a tenure track job good enough to pull us away. Who gets to change careers? And that was me.
I think that this is something that it's hard to understand on the side of it where you're an applicant, because people have such a tendency to say, well, God, it's a job. And I've known a number of people who've gotten the quote dream job, and it's been terrible. One of them was my wife. And, it's when you come right down to it, a job is a workplace, and workplaces everywhere have the same kind of pros and cons and issues that you need to think about. And I think people are trained in academia to take for granted that a job that has the right title is the right job.
Absolutely.
And that's not always the case.
Yeah, I often refer to those positions as tenure trap jobs instead of tenure track jobs because, you know, they look good and you say, well, this is what I've been training for, right? Like my whole life, this is what it's about. And then you get them and actually you find out that you might end up being stuck and you don't have an opportunity to make a lateral move and you just sort of fall into it. And before you realize what's happened, you've lost control of your career.
The proverbial rusty handcuffs. Absolutely. So what motivated the writing of your book? Why now? And, you know, what kind of impact do you hope it will make?
When I started writing the book, I really wanted to pull together two extremes of thought. And one of them was to meet academics where they were psychologically in this really critical moment of departing what many of us view as a vocation and what many of us sort of identify ourselves with. That is to say, our identity is tied up in what we do. And that creates an awful lot of psychological challenges that I think need to be addressed. But I also wanted to pull together the other extreme, like really practical advice, so that when you are dealing with a psychological crisis and depressed and don't know where to put your foot next in this journey, you can just sort of like flip through something and say, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do next. Even if I don't feel like doing it, at least I know what that is. And I can sort of keep making that forward progress. And I wanted to pull these two things together, I think in part because when I made my departure from academia, it was really during the heyday of Quitlet. And I was seeing a lot of this stuff in the market. And, you know, to be blunt, it was good to see other people leaving and saying, you know, hey, maybe this isn't for me. But it always felt a little bit whiny to me. And I would read these things and say, well, it doesn't tell me how to fix the problem. It just tells me that you have a problem too. And that is minimally helpful. And the other resources that were available that were more practical felt irrelevant to me as an academic. And I think a lot of that was probably my own arrogance as an academic, saying this can't possibly apply to my situation. And so I sort of dismissed anything that was general career advice. And the other stuff that was on the market at that time that was, I think, more pragmatic was still written in a way that felt anecdotal. It was like, well, somebody did this, somebody did that, somebody did a third thing. But it didn't give really prescriptive advice and say, you should do this next. And really what I just needed was somebody to sort of grab me by the shoulders and shake me and say, all right, like just get it together and start moving in this direction. And eventually things will be okay. Something will stick. And so my book was really trying to bring those two things together and do so in a way that I think was really not being met by the literature that existed when I was leaving in 2017.
I think what is different about your book from Quitlet, as you said, is they often talk about why they're leaving, but they don't know, they don't tell you either how to go somewhere else or why you might. You know, I mean, I think about some of the kind of giant major things like Aaron Bartram and Rebecca Schumann in this area, that, you know, people who've made a big splash and they both really have. And both of them are telling you that it's a rotten business, but they're also telling you that they wish they could stay in the rotten business. And that's understandable, but it's also just a shame. You know, you might pity the person, but somebody needs to say that there's something nice on the other side and that there's not only a reason to leave or you're leaving and that's okay, but also that there's something that might work for you once you've left. And I think that that's something that you do that's really meaningful and important because, yeah, people don't know what to do.
Yeah, that's such a critical point. And I think one of the biggest challenges when you start presenting yourself as somebody who's qualified for non-academic work is that, you know, academics do tend to be backwards looking. It's a conservative discipline. Most of it is focused on research, which is knowing what other people have done before. And our identities are tied up in this. So we often get kind of caught up in this question of, a backwards looking narrative about why we are making a change. And the problem is that people outside of academia like don't actually care why you're leaving for the most part. They care what you can do for them. And they want you to be forward looking. And if you are presenting yourself as somebody who is sort of looking over your shoulder as you're moving on to the next thing. They're going to question whether you're going to stick around, and they really want to hear a more positive, forward-looking narrative about why you're excited to take on a new and different challenge, and potentially why academia wasn't satisfying those desires. And that might justify why you're looking for something new, but they want you giving that positive statement of what you want to do next instead of what you wish you'd been able to do instead.
I think that relationships do a really great job of illuminating this. You know, if you were to ask somebody to marry you and they said, well, why do you want to marry me? And you said, well, because that person won't marry me. That's not going to work. You're the only one left who might say yes. No one wants that. No one wants to hear that. And that's what academics spend a lot of their time doing, is saying, well, there's nothing else, so I'm going to give this a try. And even if that's true, even if in your heart of hearts you know and believe that, it wouldn't work any more than that marriage proposal would.
That's such a good analogy. I'm going to steal that.
you can steal that, but at least it's on record that you're stealing it.
That's right.
So how do you see COVID influencing higher ed, and how do you think, or will it impact the kind of advice that you would give to graduate students now?
Back at the beginning of the pandemic, I had written a piece for Inside Higher Ed that said, like, hey, this is going to drive an awful lot of people away. And it was sort of an easy prediction to make, given sort of how things were changing and how rapidly they were changing with the shift to virtual and the rest. But that is obviously borne out in academia, but elsewhere too. And I think maybe the better thing to say, speaking here in 2021, is that the Great Resignation is hitting higher education as much as it's hitting just about every other industry. And I think that for so many of us, without social connections, we've had more times to think about what we might want out of our careers. And we've also had a lot of time to stew about the things that bother us. And I think that, you know, a lot of people say, well, the Great Resignation is people choosing to prioritize different things in their life. My view is a little bit different because I'm a pessimist at heart. I think people are just ready to have different problems than they've been living with for the last 20 months, which leads you to the same place, but is a slightly different take. All that aside, I think that this reassessment that's happening is largely positive. And I think that it's good for individuals to know what they want out of life and to find a job that suits those desires. And I think it's good for people to know what kind of treatment they aren't willing to live with. Somebody who's done a great job of this is Monica Cox, who's an engineer and has spoken an awful lot about how eye-opening it was as a Black woman to not be in the office every day and to sort of realize just how many compromises she was making day to day. And she's become quite vocal on those points in light of COVID. And I think, ultimately this is good. And this time to pause and figure out what you want is essential, because until you really know what you want out of your life and how you want to spend your time, any job that you pick is sort of like throwing a dart at the board and hoping that you get a bullseye, right? And the likelihood of you resenting whatever trade-offs you need to make if you're just taking whatever's available is extremely high. On the other hand, if you've figured out what you want out of life, what you're unwilling to accept in a job, you're more likely to find something that's satisfying, or at least that you can live with, until you figure out what that next thing is going to be.
I remember at the beginning of the pandemic, there were a bunch of articles predicting that this was going to cause huge impacts to people's relationships. And I haven't seen evidence that that's been the case. Instead, what people have realized is when you spend enough time away from your workplace, you start to wonder if that workplace was really worth it. And I think that's really driven a lot. I know a lot of people who took for granted that they go to the office every day, and now they're thinking to themselves, why do I have to do that? I was doing my work fine. And I do think it's caused a reevaluation. And there's no place where that's truer than in academia, because you were taught for the past who knows how many years just to assume that any job that came along was good enough for you. I got a job, and they say, is it tenure track? And you say yes, and that's the end of it. And that was and that was it. And we're seeing a sea change that I do think will impact academia.
To pile onto that, you know, if somebody is thinking about looking for work outside of higher ed, like now is absolutely the time. The market is favoring employees more than it ever has in my lifetime. Certainly, all of the reports that I see on LinkedIn and elsewhere are saying it's kind of it, within the lifetimes of anybody much older than me. And people are desperate for good talent. Salaries are really high. And people are maybe more willing to take a risk on somebody with an untraditional background than they might be in 2 years' time when this all settles out. And so I think that there is also sort of that market force incentive for people. You know, if you think you want to make a change, like it might be easier now than it will be later. And it's absolutely worth considering that if you think academia maybe might not be for you.
We're in a different time than we have ever been in, and we don't know what's going to stick, but it's certainly true right now that we're talking about more churn than there ever has been. And I saw something that somebody posted on Facebook of all places that said, "You want 3 recommendations from me for this job? Can I get 3 of your employees vouching for the employer?" And I had never thought about it before, but people are now thinking to themselves, "Yeah, you want me to prove myself, but how about you do the same?" And we've always said, and it always felt a little false, that when you're interviewing with a company, you're interviewing them as well as trying to prove to them that you're worth it. And I always felt like, yeah, that's great, but you actually don't have any money and you don't have anything. And if this is going to work out for you, then you're probably going to bend over backwards. But I do think that now things are different in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely.
What skills do institutions that do hire PhDs appreciate in a candidate, do you think? And what skills, on the other hand, would employers wish that a PhD had or wish that the person was better at articulating?
Let's start with the good and the things I think PhDs from all disciplines do really well. Number one, we're trained to absorb and synthesize huge amounts of complex information. And the training that we get in doctoral programs is really unparalleled. I haven't met anybody with a different background who's been able to do that quite as well, especially when you're dealing with amorphous or ambiguous information. PhDs do really, really well with that type of data. I think, you know, relatedly, PhDs can get up to speed really quickly and connect dots that others can't see. We are professional students, and we just know how to dig into something and get the lay of the land and know enough about it to be able to make it work, whether that's because we had to do something tangential for a research or because a friend asked us to teach a class for them and, we had to get smart fast. So PhDs can do that really well. Self-motivation is never an issue with a PhD. If you're not doing this for yourself, you're not going to get through, right? So drive is never a problem for a PhD. And I think most PhDs are really good at taking criticism. And we often don't feel like we are because academia is so sometimes petty and nasty with how it delivers criticism. But once you're in a business setting where people do sort of a criticism sandwich where they say something good, then say the bad thing and end with something good, that actually feels kind of nice. And so you can deal with it really well and adjust in a way that other people, I think, get ego tied up in a little bit more. And so PhDs are good in those 4 areas. On the other side, it's funny you ask this question because I'd asked a mentor of mine to tweet about this yesterday. And so I when he sent me this question ahead of time, I'm like, okay, I got to go and check the tweet. But he gave 4 that I think are really good. And there's one that I would add. The first thing he said is that academics often fall flat on delivering crisp and clear communications. Right, we tend to have long sentences, we tend to have florid sentences, and at a certain point, you just need to get your ideas out, use plain language, and as I like to put it, when I was like watching TV to prepare for a career transition, like it helps to talk stupid a little bit, and I don't mean that in a disparaging way, just that like academics try to talk smart. And when you go and speak with people from different backgrounds, that makes it harder for you to bridge the gulf between your experiences. Project management skills for complex jobs is another place where PhDs sometimes fall short. I suspect folks in the sciences do better with this because they're already used to working in labs where they're managing people and have multiple work streams happening simultaneously. You know, in the humanities, if it really is just you, you can probably keep all your stuff on track and get it done, but you might not know how to manage somebody below you or manage expectations of somebody above you all that well. There's a big difference between a boss and an advisor, actually. Emotional intelligence is a third. This is tough because it's something I think you can develop it, but it takes longer to develop than a lot of other skills. So very often it looks like you either have it or you don't. But being really sensitive to the politics of a situation, to delivering feedback in an empathetic way, and being able to know the right time to say the right thing. Academics sometimes lack that because we're trained just to give criticism when we see something wrong. The other thing that my mentor mentioned is the ability to relate your work to people from outside of your discipline. There's this translation issue for academics where because we spend so much time only talking to folks in our discipline, we kind of forget how to talk to people from other backgrounds and communicate with them. And you need to spend time practicing that. Otherwise, nobody's going to believe that your experience is relevant to whatever they're doing. So his four are clear communications, project management, emotional intelligence, and this translation. The thing I would add is that academics are really good at criticizing, and we're really bad at giving viable alternatives. And I think in a non-academic setting, if somebody has an idea and you want to say it's a bad idea, that's fine. But there is an expectation that you will always simultaneously say, and what we should do instead is this. And I think this requires a bit of a mindset shift and sort of playing differently in the sandbox than you're used to in academia. And you need to be ready to be a sort of contributing member of the discussion rather than somebody who is just saying why you can't do things. And I think that's a place where when I've heard about academics sort of stumbling a little bit outside of the academy, that's a big one.
One of them that I note that you said was about project management. And I can say that I've known very few humanists who've come in early and under budget. It's not really how people carry out their PhDs in academia necessarily, at least in the humanist and sometimes social science fields. I do think that that's possibly where people in STEM have a leg up because I think that's more required and expected. But, you know, maybe I'll finish in 6 years or maybe it'll be seven. That's, I think, really common and more than 6 or 7 for humanists.
Yeah. Although it's funny because I think when you look hard enough, you can start to find places where actually academic training could get you there, even on the humanities side. Chris Humphrey, who's a project manager and a career advisor in the UK, runs a site called Jobs on Toast. He has observed that actually, you know, his training as a historian and establishing chronologies and timelines was really good training for his work in project management, because he said it's basically project management is just a forward-looking chronology instead of a backward-looking chronology. And once he pieced that together, it got easier for him to sort of translate some of those past skills. But as you said, looking back, there's no deadline, and looking forward, there often is.
I think that's actually so interesting about the historian anecdote, because I think how many people have within them the ability to, and I don't mean this as in nobody, but I do mean there are probably many people who have the capacity to translate in that kind of savvy way. Oh, my work is doing this, but here I could do this, and it's really using the same skill. That's the ticket. And I think that there's so many fields for which that's true. I mean, I'm coming out of an English PhD, I both know how to teach people how to write. Hopefully I also know how to write, but I know how to interpret and to find streams of interpretation that enrich something and cause it to be understood in a different way. And I realize that if you can articulate it like that, I think that's a readily valued skill. And it's just a matter, though, of being able to do that and to stop talking about Finnegan's Wake, in my case, and to start talking a little bit more about what I could do with a text like that.
Yeah, that's right. You know, saying how you do your work instead of what you do is big, and why it matters is even more important than that, right? The metaphor I always like to use in this context is one of translation. And if I tell you that I'm a PhD in classics and I know Latin really well, that's great. And if I tell you that I want to translate Virgil from Latin into Japanese, hopefully your first question is, well, do you know Japanese? And if I say, well, yes. Well, no, but I'm a really good Latinist, then like, hold on, there's a problem here, right? It doesn't matter how good I am at Latin. I can't get it into Japanese until I understand that language, that culture, and know how to make some of those tough decisions when you're translating not just concepts like walk, but kind of culturally specific things that are nuanced and messy. That's where translation gets hard. And I can't even begin until I know Japanese. And I think with professional life and careers and work experience, it's the same thing. Anybody who's a PhD is fluent in academia. So you can explain your work to academics just fine. But if you go in to meet somebody in consulting or nonprofit management, like you need to spend time learning their language before you're going to be able to translate. And so this requires an effort on your part to meet with these people, to talk with them as humans, to be inquisitive and curious, and to learn about what they do and start developing that base level grammar and hopefully a fluency in how they speak. And once you have that, it actually gets pretty easy to translate from your academic experience to their language because you know it. But if you just say, well, I'm going to tell them what I do and they should value it, that's crazy. It just doesn't work.
No, that's never effective. And I've certainly seen people where they say, here's my cover letter. And it's, you know, it starts familiarly with the second paragraph saying, my dissertation advised by and so on. And, you know, you think about that and you realize they don't have an interest in that. But there are things in that that you can convey. It's possible. But it is an act of translation. I think that's a really wonderful metaphor. So to close, I'm wondering, what would you like to convey, if there were one thing to convey to grad students now, what would that be?
PhDs are trained to believe that if you think through a problem for long enough, if you have no budget and no timeline constraints, that you will be able to figure something out. And your career is a place where that thinking doesn't work. No amount of thinking this through by yourself is going to get you out of a career conundrum. What you need to do is ask for help from other people so you don't need to reinvent the wheel. And also realize that at this point in your life, after 5 or 10 years of advanced study, learning more isn't going to help you. You need to start doing and acting. And those are going to be the things that really help you move forward. So ask for help and start doing right away.
I love that. And that's actually how you learn how to translate. If you don't start to ask people and talk to people, you're not going to know the language. You can't stay on this side and surmise what's going on over there. Sometimes I find that PhDs ask me questions about what a workplace is like. And I say, well, why would you ask me? Ask the person who's in the workplace. You know, they say, I don't know what I would say to somebody. And then they have 8 really great questions that they ask me about it. And it's, you know, write them down, get in touch with somebody who does something cool that you want to learn about, and ask them these really great, honest questions and see where you land. And I that's the beginning of that process of translation that you described.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, in academia, everybody is so accustomed to say, well, you know, everybody is busy and pressed for time. And I think you're acculturated to not want to impose on people's time because of that. And, you know, I was the sort of guy who spent 30 minutes writing an email to my advisor asking for a 15-minute meeting, which is an insane use of time. but like out, outside of the academy, it is completely normal to ask somebody for an informational interview and to ask them for 30 minutes of their time just to collect some information. And most people will say yes, and you're not doing anything rude unless you make that ask in the form of a two-page email that they haven't asked for.
Which I have seen. I've had to pare that back. I'm sure I've done it too. Well, thank you so much for joining me. I think that this has been really valuable. It's one of those podcasts where I hope that everybody listens. And if there's a podcast that you listen to, I think this would be the one. So thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks so much for having me, Dan.
And thank you for listening.